Ready?
Let's go.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another week of Church on Screens or Socks or whatever we say. We just found out we're still in the red, so who knows when this will be over. We're finishing Ruth today and next week. We're finishing Ruth 4. We'll go as far as we can today. And then next week, we'll finish it up with the last couple verses. And then a big conclusion wrap-up kind of thing. And then, just so you know where we're going from there, we'll go into 1 John. And we'll go through that as long as that takes us. And then we're going to get into Acts. Luke's second book after the book of Luke. He also wrote Acts. And that details the early church, and I just think there's so much there, so many parallels, so much relevant to us today as far as being the church and living and moving in the culture and what we're called to, what we're called into. I think it's gonna be so full and rich, both of those books actually. So that's what we're gonna do. Once we get into the yellow, what they call the yellow, I think we're gonna have some more options as far as you've probably seen online or anything like that there have been churches that are outside. There have been different kind of creative models. I think the church has been really, really great. I don't think that can be said throughout history, but I think that the church has been really, really progressive and really interesting and creative as far as our response to this whole shutdown, I think as far as reaching people and bringing the gospel and the love of Jesus to people and the peace in the middle of this disruption and an uncertainty, I think that the church has been really, really amazing. So it'll be really interesting to see where this all leaves us. So that'll be an interesting conversation to continue going forward. That's a lot of what we talk about during the weeks. In the blog posts and in the minis and things like that, as far as culturally and what all this means. But today, Ruth 4, where we left was, it's a happy ending. It's a happy ending. Mr. So-and-so didn't bother, didn't do his business as it was laid out in the Torah. And he was supposed to redeem the land and Ruth. He decided Ruth was a deal breaker. So rather than, he just didn't want to deal with the inconvenience or the disruption to his life, so he walked away from it. He decided not to, so Boaz is going to redeem the land. Ruth, we're going to have our happy ending that we've been hoping for since chapter 1, verse 1. So now we are in verse... But let's start with verse 9. Chapter 4, verse 9. When we look at Ruth, it's about 20% of the way in the Bible. If you have your Bible, you can open that up. I always really like to read my Bible. I study out of online, but I don't think there's anything that can really compare to having the Bible. I like books anyway. So whatever you want to do. Chapter 4, verse 9. Then Boaz said to the leaders, and it's a little bit like a strobe light in here, and it feels a little like a club, doesn't it? So it's kind of fun. So we're trying a couple of new things. Maybe next week we'll have a disco ball in here. It'll be fun. So then Boaz said to the leaders and to the crowd standing around, "You are witnesses that today I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, and with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown." And he says again, "You are all witnesses today." Cool thing. David Guzik says, Boaz had a love for Ruth that was public. A love that wanted to be publicly witnessed. Now, culturally, we are moving away from the significance and the importance of an actual marriage. You hear things like, well, can't we be married? Can't we just be married before God? Or we're already married in the eyes of God, trying to avoid the actual ceremony, the actual wedding. We're trying to, there's that saying, put the cart before the horse. That's what we're doing. We're trying to invert all of this order so that the wedding is almost the least important thing. The marriage is almost the least important thing. And I can understand that, but there is something missing. There's something lacking in a love and in a commitment that doesn't want to proclaim itself, that doesn't want witnesses, that doesn't want the bond to be recognized by the authorities or by others. There's something missing there. There's just, if you have a pie, its pieces missing. And it can be really, really big pieces missing. No matter what you think, no matter what you think, what side you come down on of the marriage debate, okay, that's happening in our country and worldwide, kind of, but especially in our country, the fight for it, the fight for marriage that rages on, shows perhaps a greater reverence, a greater reverence for the institution, right? Right? Think about that. Think about how having something allows us to take it a bit for granted. Think about how high the divorce rate is. There are people that are fighting for the right to get married, and so many men and women are trying to look for any excuse not to. It's just that crazy thing. There's a fight for a right and a privilege that we take so much for granted. I think it's part of that reverence. I think we've forgotten the beauty and the reverence and the beauty, the reverence, the weight of an actual wedding, of an actual marriage. There is a sacredness to the public ceremony. There's a sacredness to doing something with witnesses, right? It's like a baptism. Now, you don't have to. You don't have to be baptized. You don't have to be baptized in front of your community or your family. But the impulse not to, right? The impulse not to do it, the impulse to keep it a secret, the impulse to quiet it down and to not, to keep it private. That sure says something, doesn't it? That sure does say something. A love that won't shout about it, about itself, that sure speaks to something, doesn't it? David Guzik also says, so those who say, well, if we were on a desert island and no one was there to marry us, could we still be married before God? Need to hear the answer, yes. Yes, and over we say this, you don't have to. You don't have to do these things. Yes, of course, you're still married before God on a desert island. But we are not on a desert island. We are not on a desert island at all. There are witnesses and there are civil authorities for you to proclaim your commitment of marital love to. God wants you to. God wants you to. God wants this in the light. God made this, okay? When you think about marriage, God made it. God ordained it. God put so much into it about this love and commitment and wants the world to see it. Wants the world to see it done well, done in a healthy way. It's an inspiration for all of us. Have you ever been around a couple with a totally healthy marriage? They're still fighting. That's part of a healthy marriage. There's still trouble. We're still different people. But in a marriage that looks like a triangle with the two people and God at the other corner, all supporting each other, all giving into each other. It's a picture of the Trinity, of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, with each one receiving and each one giving in this beautiful way. When you see that, when you see a relationship that's based on respect and kindness and love and service, you can't even imagine. I talk about, with this thing, with this shutdown and everything, I have said over and over in this house, we are built for this. We are built for it because we really like each other. We really, really like each other here. We like to spend time with each other. We give to each other. We have our time apart from each other, but we like to be together. Imagine what this would be like if that marriage relationship wasn't the way that it's supposed to be. Wouldn't be that inspirational triangle of things where you find out about this time that you don't really like the person that you're married to, right? There's that time where you go, oh no, I don't want to. How many relationships do their best to spend time away from each other? Well, now we can't. So now you're finding out an awful lot about your lives, about what your marriage is based on, and how things could be addressed, right? So there's so much to talk about with marriage here, but what we're actually bringing it back to, and I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but mostly Boaz is talking about the witnesses. And now, when we talk about witnesses, we have to ask a question. Have you ever kept a secret from somebody? Have you ever been a secret from somebody or from anything? Have you that weight of keeping secrets? And if that secret happens to be a person, or if you're that person that's a secret, and you have to be really careful where you step, what you say, how you do it, right? All of these things, all secrets and all hiddenness carry with them a certain level of shame, of guilt. They carry with them this sense that you might be doing the wrong thing. Just by the fact that you feel like you have to keep it hidden. Know what I mean? There are businesses that have fences that you can't see through so that nobody sees you go inside. Grocery stores don't have that, right? You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about. Those things, whenever we feel like we have to hide something, we have made the decision. Now, we're not even talking judgment here, because nobody else has decided this. We decide what needs to be kept a secret. And that thing, we have added the shame and the guilt to the picture. It's this thing. Okay, there's two examples in this book, in the book of Ruth. There's one, when you go to a guy's threshing floor in the middle of the night and crawl under his blanket. You don't do that in the middle of the day. You don't go up and the flip side of that is Boaz going first thing in the morning where all the people are to the city gate and saying, you are all witnesses today. See the difference? See the difference? One is in the middle of the night, under cover of darkness, sliding in where nobody is to keep a secret. And the other one goes to the city gates with his hands up and says, you're all witnesses. Everybody pay attention. If you have to hide something, okay? If you feel like you have to hide something. And again, whenever we talk about this, there's a disclaimer that says, we're not talking about advertising everything. There are things that are personal and private. And let's just know that we all know what the difference is. Right? We all know what the difference is. We all know the things that you don't just want to talk about outside with your neighbor. But I'm talking about when you hide something, when you keep secrets, right? They're okay. Whenever we do that, if you have to hide something, if you feel like you have to hide something, maybe that's something you're feeling conflicted about doing in the first place. Maybe that's something that's less than the best thing for you. Maybe that's something that makes you love you less. Maybe that's something that's tearing you apart inside. Think of the weight that comes with keeping a secret, with watching where you've been and watching what you say and watching what your history is on your computer, think about how much goes into the deception, because you've ascribed something that may not even be there. It may not even be there. Okay, let's take a step apart. Food and eating. The meal has always been sacred. The community meal has always been a sacred thing. It's all through the scriptures, and it matters who you eat with, how you eat, the people that you eat with. It's beautiful. I always say, we always have this thing, if you had, you know, so much to live, how would you spend that day? And I always say, I would spend it at a meal with my friends, with my family and my friends. That's what I would do. There's something so sacred about the meal. And you think about it, you take it even further, the food. The food, we are thankful. There's just so much gratitude tied up in that. We're grateful for the provision of God. We're grateful for how delicious the food is. We're grateful for the people that we're with, that God has provided these people in our life. See what I mean? There's so much involved here. Oh, no. Oh, no. So, the thing shut down. So, let me just get something clear. I don't know how long you've been with me, but I keep notes, and I keep, I put tons and tons of preparation. Isn't she beautiful today? Sometimes we get jammies, but today she's all foxed up for us, so there's that. Anyway, I keep all of these notes, not because I'm unprepared or not because I need them. I could talk forever. But so that we keep it inside of a structure that gets us out of here before dinner time, okay? So, now, there's food. There's this communal act of gratitude for the food, for each other, for another breath. It's worship. It's praise for the God that provides. Now, the first time that came up in the scriptures is Isaac. Abraham took Isaac up on a mountain to sacrifice him. God told him to sacrifice his son. Takes him up and is going to do this, and there's so much to that. I'm not even going to get into that. But the point is, as he's about to do it, God stops him, and then there's a ram. And this all comes from the God that provides that ram. The words are Jehovah Jireh, okay? So that's what we're talking about, that the God that provides. That's what every meal is, okay? That's one. The sacred meal, the sacred community meal. And then there's hiding candy bars under your bed and binging them after everybody has gone to bed. Still eating. You're still eating, but you see the difference. Do you see the difference? One is Boaz saying, "You're all witnesses," and the other one's in the middle of the night crawling into someone's bed. See what I mean? See, there's a difference. One is having a meal with your friends and your family and the people that matter to you, and the other one is hiding in a corner so nobody can see while you jam down food that you've apparently decided you shouldn't be eating. So you see what I mean? And I shouldn't say you, I should say we, because we all have these spaces in our lives, right? We all do. We all do. So the point is to take a look at those. If we have to hide something, maybe that something isn't helping us. Right? Maybe we need to take a second look at it. And maybe that thing is causing us to love us less. And the point of the scriptures is to love us more. To be reminded that we are worthy of love, that we are accepted, that we are the ones, that we are the children of God. Okay? Don't forget that. Don't forget that. And anything takes us away from that love is a different kind of thing. That's where we start to get away from God's idea. Shame and guilt never came from God. Never. Never. Okay? Okay, moving on. Then the leaders and all the people standing there replied, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is now coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, from whom all the nation of Israel descended. May you be great in Ephrathah and famous in Bethlehem, and may the Lord give your descendants by this young woman who will be like those of our ancestor Perez, the son of Tamar and Judah. Now. This is so charged. This is so charged and heavy, it is unbelievable that is the example that they will pick. That these people will pick, and that the writer of the book of Ruth will put in here. Okay, I'm going to tell you why. The Bible's a weird book. We need to know that. Okay, they say the family be like that of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah. As honorable, remember honorable, and numerous as his. He was the ancestor of the Bethlehem people, and his family one of the five from which the tribe of Judah sprang. Okay, you with me so far? Now, there are some interesting parallels. Tamar was also a foreigner. Okay, she was a Canaanite woman. And Ruth is a Moabitess. Okay, these are really, really big details. Okay, so that's true about them. Judah was a kinsman redeemer when Tamar's first two husbands died. Now, the thing about that is that he was the kinsman redeemer, but he wasn't that by choice. And now this is where, have you ever seen the show Jerry Springer? There are show, or Maury Povich, or something like that. Sometimes the Bible, you wouldn't let your kids watch it if you would write letters to the TV station if it was on in the middle of the day. So here we go. In Genesis 38, okay, Judah is the father of some folks. Tamar marries them and moves on, and then she goes through two of them. And then she's supposed to marry the third, but here we'll start in chapter 38, verse 14. Tamar was aware that Shelah had grown up, but they had not called her to come and marry him. So she changed out of her widow's clothing and covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. Then she sat beside the road at the entrance to the village of Enaim, which is on the way to Timnah. Judah noticed her as he went by. Now Judah's got a family. Judah's got a whole big thing going on. Judah noticed her as he went by and thought she was a prostitute since her face was veiled. So he stopped and propositioned her to sleep with him, not realizing she was his own daughter-in-law. "How much will you pay me?" Tamar asked. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock." "Excuse me, what pledge will you give me so I can be sure you'll send it?" "Well, what do you want?" he inquired. She replied, "I want your identification seal, your cord, and the walking stick you're carrying." So Judah gave these items to her. Now this is her father-in-law. So she then let him sleep with her, and she became pregnant. Okay? Now. I'm just going to synopsize this and say what happens is Tamar becomes pregnant, has a child, and Judah has lost his mind with this righteous indignation that we all have and says, "Oh my gosh, she should not be pregnant by another man," and loses his mind. And then he finds out because all the things that he gave to this prostitute along the road, Tamar has, and so does her child. It's a gross story. It's a gross story, but this is the one they're saying, may you be blessed like them. Bible's a weird book. Bible's a weird book, man. Kung Fu Panda, and there's wisdom of the Bible in Kung Fu Panda 2, when the soothsayer says, your story may not have such a happy beginning, but that does not make you who you are. Here's the thing. Here's the thing about the Bible that's so comforting. It's so comforting and it's so eye-opening. When you see the story of Tamar and Judah, you are shocked. You are shocked because it's daytime trash TV. Trash TV. If you like it, you can like it. I don't care. But it's daytime TV. Okay? And we go, oh, that's terrible when they're throwing chairs across the thing and they're fighting and pulling hair. But that, over and over, we see is not enough to be disqualified from God and his plan for redemption. It's unbelievable. What he does over and over and over is redeem stories just like this. Paul used to be named Saul and was going around killing people who loved Jesus. And Jesus took that and made it sing, man. Made it sing. So that we're still following the words of Paul. We're still reading and studying the words of Paul. Unbelievable. Gideon is scared to death. Moses, I can't talk. Find somebody else. Over and over and over. And he was a murderer. David. All day we can go, me, you, everybody. What God does is takes these things, stories just like this, redeems them and turns them into something awesome. Whenever you, and sometimes people know this, when people come to me, they will say, oh, this happened to me, whatever. And I say, but once you're past it, once you've recovered, once you've healed, you're going to have the best story. You're going to have the best story. I had a flood. We lost everything in our flood, and it was horrible. But even at the time, I knew afterwards I will be able to relate to people on a completely different level. Completely different level. And that can bring relationship. That can bring healing. That could bring redemption to a really, really ugly story. Okay. We very often make decisions about us and about others based on judgment, shame, guilt, what we think and what we understand with our eyes and our culture, right? Maybe as we study the Bible, the more and more we see is that it's an invitation. It's an invitation to maybe put our judgment, guilt, shame, our ideas, our opinions of who's in and who's out, maybe put those aside and start to make decisions based on God's plan, on God's eyes, on God's hands, on God's definitions. And when we talk about definitions of in and out in God's eyes, everybody's in. That's the interesting part. That's the really interesting part. Maybe we should do that instead. So, now then we look at Tamar and Perez, right? And that story that these people say, hey, may you be blessed like them. It would be really, really interesting to hear what happens to their story. I wonder if anything interesting happened to those crazy kids that maybe we can find out next time. If anything good ever comes from such an inappropriate beginning, right? Maybe we'll find out next week. Maybe we will. So, anyway, moving on. Verse 13. Well, I already closed my Bible. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. See how it's just a happily ever after right now. It's a happily ever after. So this story has now come full circle. And now it's beautiful. And now we have conception. So the big question about this is, do we see conception? Conception as the gift of God that it is. And that leads us to a much bigger question, and do we see life as the gift of God that it is? And what I'm talking about isn't necessarily life. Life means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And sometimes when you say life, you're just thinking, I got out of bed this morning, I'm still breathing. But there's so much more in life, in living, than the scriptures and in God's economy. It's a fulfillment. It's exactly the same as our idea of peace and God's idea of shalom. It includes all of life. It includes all of life. The God's arms and God's definitions are so much bigger than ours. We can't even get our brains around how big this idea of life is. How many of us are just getting up, going through our routines. That's not living. That's not living in God's idea. All of this that makes a life, that makes us fulfilled. Choose life. There, I set before you life and death. And oftentimes when we talk about eternal life, we think about something that happens to us after we have a physical death. But the Bible doesn't really ever see it that way. The Bible sees them as present realities. We can either, they're like parallel lines. We can either choose death in every step of our lives, everything we do now, today, or we can choose life. And every decision we make buys into that, gives us away with what we're choosing. Every day. It's not something that happens. It's not an escape plan for later. It's now. It's now today. It's in every way. It's so much bigger than we ever acknowledge it to be. So, are we acknowledging life? The light and living as the gift of God that it is. And you probably see where we're going because we've gone here so many times. Sometimes, a lot of times, we take for granted. We take for granted the most extraordinary, the most miraculous events, and we just call them coincidence or random or a happy accident, right? We often that's often how we go through our lives. We go through them blind with blinders on, not seeing the world as what's happening around us, as the actual truth that's happening around us. Now, here's going to be a fun time. There's a movie called Pulp Fiction. And if you've seen it, you know why I can't show you the clip of it. But what I'm going to do, once I'm in the early stages of the bridge, I had two actors act out a scene from Fight Club because it was so valuable. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to have those same two actors come back and act out a beautiful scene from Pulp Fiction. And the scene is, we have two guys. You have Jules and Vincent. Jules Winfield and Vincent Vega. And, well, I know it's church. They're hitmen. And they go in to kill a guy, and a guy comes out with a big gun and shoots at them and somehow misses them. Shoots at them from a very close range and somehow misses them, and they end up killing him. I know, it's not a church movie, but the conversation afterwards is absolutely a church conversation to have. So I will invite my very extra special actors up. And who we have here, we have Elisha Slabach right here, and we have Samuel Slabach here. They are huge, and they are awesome actors. So, please, who do we have here? We have Vincent Vega right here, and we have Jules Winfield right here. Okay? Action. Man, I've just been sitting here thinking.
About what?
About the miracle we just witnessed.
The miracle you witnessed. I witnessed a freak accident.
What is a miracle, Vincent?
An art of God.
What is an act of God?
When, God makes the impossible possible. But this morning, I don't think that qualifies.
Hey, Vincent, don't you see? That stuff don't matter. You're judging this stuff the wrong way. I mean, it could be that God stopped the bullets, or he changed Coke to Pepsi. He found my car keys. You don't judge stuff like this based on merit. Now, whether or not what we experienced was an, according to Hoyle, miracle is insignificant. What is significant is that I felt the touch of God. God got involved.
But why?
Well, that's what's been messing with me. I don't know why, but I can't go to sleep. Thank you very much, boys. You know what else is a miracle? That I got those boys in front of a camera to do that for me today. Isn't that fun? So let me just repeat, so that hopefully you caught those lines. Now, whether or not what we experienced was an, according to Hoyle, miracle is insignificant. What is significant is that I felt the touch of God. God got involved. And then they say, why? Well, I don't know why, but that's what's messing with me. That's the thing. The act of God. God makes the impossible possible. Okay, now why do we talk about this? It's an issue of perspective, right? Like so many things in our lives, it's an issue of perspective, of how we see things. We can live with our eyes wide open in a world of miracles where God gets involved. Or we can go back to sleep. Like Jules said, but I can't go back to sleep. We can go back to sleep. We can do that. We can do that. We miss. How many burning bushes do you think that we miss? I so much like to go back to that story in Exodus 3 where Moses sees the burning bush and God is speaking through the burning bush. The thing is, it's burning, which bushes do all the time, okay? But the thing was, it wasn't being consumed. And the fact that it wasn't being consumed and Moses noticed it means that he was aware. He was attentive. He was present. How many times do we walk by burning bushes that aren't being consumed, but we don't ever notice it because we just see a burning bush? Big deal. But it's not being consumed. We just haven't had the attention to pay to it. We just don't have our eyes open to what's actually happening. It's perspective, man. There's forgiveness. There's generosity, there's kindness, there's grace, there's care, there's love in all of its many, many, many forms. Those are miracles, man. Those are absolute miracles. I know these two women, and one woman did something horrible to the other woman, okay? They're now friends. They're now friends again because of forgiveness. That's a miracle. That's a miracle. There's no reason, evolutionarily speaking, that we would forgive. There's no reason for that. You think about these people who have had the most horrible things done to them. I think about that shooting in Narvon, in Lancaster County. A gunman came in and shot up a bunch of kids. And in their interviews, those people, it was an Amish town, and they came and they had their opportunity, and they said, "Well, we forgive him." That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking because we live in a culture and in a world that says, "You've done this to me, I'm going to do this and more to you." Right? We live in justice. And yet, sometimes forgiveness happens. You ever see a marriage continue after something has happened? How do people get the strength to do that? How do people get the strength and the overwhelming courage to continue? You see people who have lost children. You see people who have lost spouses that somehow get out of bed. Right? You see people give. You see these extraordinary acts of generosity towards other people. Why would you do that? We live in a culture that says there's this much. There's a pie of this much. And if you give away some, that means there's less for you. Yet we give. Why? Why would we do that? That's unbelievable. Those things are unbelievable. People choose to go into other people's sadness all the time. And it's uncomfortable. It's when you get that kind of sadness and that kind of brokenness, our instinct is to run. And sometimes we walk straight into it. We walk straight into it. You know what the country, the world is being asked to do right now? Put your self-interest on the shelf. Put your self-interest behind you. Now, this is, I could also say what, I could give another perspective to it too, but it's all about how we see things. The whole humanity is being asked to put your self-interest aside to give grace to someone else. And they're doing it. They're doing it. That is shocking. shocking, just to use a small example. If there is one piece of chocolate left, my wife will, in every situation, give it to somebody else. Give it away. I think about my friend, the Niesels, who used to be here. The thing that I said about them all the time was, if you ask them for $10 and they had five, they would borrow the other five to give it to you and then worry about paying that back. That's who they are. Now, why would they do that? There's no reason. There's no reason. These things are miracles. They're absolute miracles. And then you start to take things around. Go outside. There's flowers blooming that you planted years ago that are coming up. That's unbelievable. You'll have a hot meal today, maybe. You'll have a meal today. You probably had breakfast. These things are shocking. These things can't be taken for granted. They just can't. This world is just cracking with the sacred everywhere we look. Everywhere we look. If only we have eyes to see and ears to hear. So are we gonna wake up now? Or are we going to wake up later? Because if we wake up later, we are called straight back to Genesis 28:16, where David wakes up, Jacob wakes up and says, God was here all along and I missed it. Think about the people who are here and who have passed. Think about all the things that you missed about them. Think about all the wonderful things that they did. I talk about my dad all the time. But I think about the things that I missed, wanting him to be something else. But in wanting him to be something else, or in all of the tension, what I missed were all the really, really cool things about him, all the amazing things about him, all the things that he gave, all the things that he showed, the complete miraculous things that happened that I missed. Now I'm Jacob saying, God was here all along, and I missed it. And I missed it. How many times? How many times? We talked before about when my sister was thinking about moving back to California. She's so close. And if she moves back, I'll have to say, God was here all along, and I missed it. Think about the people in your houses that you're frustrated that they don't clean up their room while you're missing every awesome thing about them. Right? Think about how you go about your day, about how you, the people that you worked with. Right now, it's such an easy sell to go back to Genesis and say, we're made for other people, because right now we understand that there are people, we miss people. Yes, I do believe we are made to be with people. When 2 months ago we thought, no, I'd really like a lot of alone time. Now we're going, I just need people. See, we've taken all of these things for granted. Over and over and over, we've missed it. We've missed so much. And it's just, the Bible is an invitation to wake up. To wake up, and Pulp Fiction is an invitation to wake up. You don't think of Pulp Fiction as a particularly Christian movie, but it kind of is. It kind of is. Okay, we're almost done. We are called. To be fully present. We are called to be paying attention to this lovely creation. Samuel is the biggest fan of fish that I know. If you ever look at these amazing fish, there's no reason that they're so cool. God just made them that way. When you look in Genesis, there are foods that are described as only delicious. They don't have to be delicious. There is a movement that's happening right now that food is fuel. And it's not that way to God. God wants it to taste good too. That's a miracle. These things are miraculous. And if we don't pay attention to creation, we're missing it all. We're missing it all. We're going to wake up at some point and say, I missed it. I missed it all. Even here, even now, there are things happening that we're missing. They're missing, and we're thinking about when it's going to be over. How many times do we look for what's coming and miss what's now? And miss what's happening right now? And maybe, maybe that's what gratitude is. Maybe that's what worship is. Right? There's lots of different definitions, but maybe gratitude and worship, the actual definition, the real definition, once we boil everything down, is that we notice all of these miracles and we call them exactly what they are, which is a divine gift. Let's just not miss anymore. Let's just not miss anymore. I promise you, it took me a really long time to read this book, and it took me a much longer time to see what it really is. And the whole thing is an invite for us to wake up and see everything as the gift that it is. That's it. Like a marriage, like a wedding ceremony from the beginning. Remember we were talking about that? Like the witnesses around. All of these things are gifts. Are gifts, and we start to see them as obligations or responsibilities or common. Just common. And I can't, I think that creation weeps. I think the creation weeps when we're missing that they're gifts, that this whole place is cracking with electricity that's just overflowing with these gifts, and we're just passing them by. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Now, before we go, we have a benediction, and the benediction is, may we wake up. May we wake up. May we start with the next half hour. The next half hour, seeing these gifts, hearing these gifts, looking into the eyes of the people that we see as the gifts that they are. When you get on a Zoom call, the next time you get on a Zoom call, think about just the shocking nature that I can get on my computer and see someone's face now, anywhere. You can't even wrap your head around. Imagine if someone tried to tell you that 10 years ago, 20 years ago. These things shouldn't be taken for granted, and we can't take them for granted anymore. So may we wake up to everything that's happening around us that we've missed for so long. May our eyes be finally opened. May our ears be finally opened. And may we see these gifts everywhere they are. All right, everybody. I love you. Have a great day. I'll see you next week. We finish Ruth next week. And